a quick sensibility and possessed of absolute power, refused his passions the gratification of revenge. A tyrant might have proscribed, without distinction, the lives and fortunes of the citizens of Antioch, and the unwarlike Syrians must have patiently submitted to the lust, the rapaciousness, and the cruelty of the faithful legions of Gaul. A milder sentence might have deprived the capital of the East of its honors and privileges, and the courtiers, perhaps the subjects of Julian, would have applauded an act of justice which asserted the dignity of the supreme magistrate of the Republic. But instead of abusing or exerting the authority of the state to revenge his personal injuries, Julian contented himself with an inoffensive mode of retaliation which it would be in the power of few princes to employ. He had been insulted by satires and libels. In his turn he composed, under the title of the Enemy of the Beard, an ironical confession of his own faults, and a severe satire on the licentious and effeminate manners of Antioch. This imperial reply was publicly exposed before the gates of the palace, and the Misopogon still remains a singular monument of the resentment, the wit, the humanity, and the indiscretion of Julian. Though he affected to laugh, he could not forgive. His contempt was expressed, and his revenge might be gratified by the nomination of a governor worthy only of such subjects. And the emperor, forever renouncing the ungrateful city, proclaimed his resolution to pass the ensuing winter at Tarsus in Cilicia. Yet Antioch possessed one citizen whose genius and virtues might atone, in the opinion of Julian, for the vice and folly of his country. The sophist Libanius was born in the capital of the East. He publicly professed the arts of rhetoric and declamation at Nice, Nicomedia, Constantinople, Athens, and during the remainder of his life at Antioch. His school was assiduously frequented by the Grecian youth. His disciples, who sometimes exceeded the number of 80, celebrated their incomparable master, and the jealousy of his rivals, who persecuted him from one city to another, confirmed the favorable opinion which Labanius ostentatiously displayed of his superior merit. The preceptors of Julian had extorted a rash but solemn assurance that he would never attend the lectures of their adversary. The curiosity of the royal youth was checked and inflamed. He secretly procured the writings of this dangerous sophist, and gradually surpassed in the perfect imitation of his style the most laborious of his domestic pupils. When Julian ascended the throne, he declared his impatience to embrace and reward the Syrian sophist, who had preserved in a degenerate age the Grecian purity of taste, of manners, and of religion. The emperor's prepossession was increased and justified by the discreet pride of his favorite. Instead of pressing with the foremost of the crowd into the palace of Constantinople, Libanius calmly expected his arrival at Antioch, withdrew from court on the first symptoms of coldness and indifference, required a formal invitation for each visit, and taught his sovereign an important lesson that he might command the obedience of a subject, but that he must deserve the attachment of a friend. The sophists of every age, despising or affecting to despise the accidental distinctions of birth and fortune, reserve their esteem for the superior qualities of the mind with which they themselves are so plentifully endowed. Julian might disdain the acclamations of a venal court who adored the imperial purple, but he was deeply flattered by the praise, the admonition, the freedom, and the envy of an independent philosopher who refused his favors, loved his person, celebrated his fame, and protected his memory. The voluminous writings of Labanius still exist. For the most part, they are the vain and idle compositions of an orator who cultivated the science of words, the productions of a recluse student whose mind, regardless of his contemporaries, was incessantly fixed on the Trojan War and the Athenian Commonwealth. Yet the sophist of Antioch sometimes descended from this imaginary elevation. He entertained a various and elaborate correspondence. He praised the virtues of his own times. He boldly arraigned the abuse of public and private life, and he eloquently pleaded the cause of Antioch against the just resentment of Julian and Theodosius. It is the common calamity of old age to lose whatever might have rendered it desirable. But Lavinius experienced the peculiar misfortune of surviving the religion and the sciences to which he had consecrated his genius. The friend of Julian was an indignant spectator of the triumph of Christianity, and his bigotry, which darkened the prospect of the visible world, did not inspire Labienus with any lively hopes of celestial glory and happiness. The martial impatience of Julian urged him to take the field in the beginning of the spring, and he dismissed with contempt and reproach the Senate of Antioch, who accompanied the emperor beyond the limits of their own territory, to which he was resolved never to return. After a laborious march of 2 days, he halted on the third at Baria, or Aleppo, where he had the mortification of finding a senate almost entirely Christian, who received with cold and formal demonstrations of respect the eloquent sermon of the apostle of paganism. The son of one of the most illustrious citizens of Baria, who had embraced, either from interest or conscience, the religion of the emperor, was disinherited by his angry parent. The father and the son were invited to the imperial table. Julian, placing himself between them, attempted, without success, to inculcate the lesson and example of toleration. Supported, with affected calmness, the indiscreet zeal of the aged Christian, who seemed to forget the sentiments of nature and the duty of a subject. And at length, turning towards the afflicted youth, "Since you have lost a father," said he, "for my sake it is incumbent on me to supply his place." The emperor was received in a manner much more agreeable to his wishes at Batni, a small town pleasantly seated in a grove of cypresses about 20 miles from the city of Hierapolis. The solemn rites of sacrifice were decently prepared by the inhabitants of Batni, who seemed attached to the worship of their tutelar deities, Apollo and Jupiter. But the serious piety of Julian was offended by the tumult of their applause, and he too clearly discerned that the smoke which arose from their altars was the incense of flattery rather than of devotion. The ancient and magnificent temple which had sanctified for so many ages the city of Hierapolis no longer subsisted, and the consecrated wealth which afforded a liberal maintenance to more than 300 priests might hasten its downfall. Yet Julian enjoyed the satisfaction of embracing a philosopher and a friend whose religious firmness had withstood the pressing and repeated solicitations of Constantius and Gallus, as often as those princes lodged at his house in their passage through Hierapolis. In the hurry of military preparation and the careless confidence of a familiar correspondence, the zeal of Julian appears to have been lively and uniform. He had now undertaken an important and difficult war, and the anxiety of the event rendered him still more attentive to observe and register the most trifling presages from which, according to the rules of divination, any knowledge of futurity could be derived. He informed Labienus of his progress as far as Hierapolis by an elegant epistle, which displays the facility of his genius and his tender friendship for the sophist of Antioch. Hierapolis, situated almost on the banks of the Euphrates, had been appointed for the general rendezvous of the Roman troops, who immediately passed the great river on a bridge of boats which was previously constructed. If the inclinations of Julian had been similar to those of his predecessor, he might have wasted the active and important season of the year in the circus of Samosata, or in the churches of Edessa. But as the warlike emperor, instead of Constantius, had chosen Alexander for his model, he advanced without delay to Carrhae, a very ancient city of Mesopotamia at the distance of 40 miles from Hierapolis. The temple of the moon attracted the devotion of Julian, but the halt of a few days was principally employed in completing the immense preparations of the Persian War. The secret of the expedition had hitherto remained in his own breast. But as Kahi is the point of separation of the two great roads, he could no longer conceal whether it was his design to attack the dominions of Sapor on the side of the Tigris, or on that of the Euphrates. The emperor detached an army of 30,000 men under the command of his kinsman Procopius and of Sebastian, who had been Duke of Egypt. They were ordered to direct their march towards Nisibis and to secure the frontier from the desultory incursions of the enemy before they attempted the passage of the Tigris. Their subsequent operations were left to the discretion of the generals, but Julian expected that after wasting with fire and sword the fertile districts of Media and Adiabene, they might arrive under the walls of Ctesiphon at the same time that he himself, advancing with equal steps along the banks of the Euphrates, should besiege the capital of the Persian monarchy. The success of this well-concerted plan depended in a great measure on the powerful and ready assistance of the king of Armenia, who, without exposing the safety of his own dominions, might detach an army of 4,000 horse and 20,000 foot to the assistance of the Romans. But the feeble Arsaces Tyrannus, king of Armenia, had degenerated still more shamefully than his father Chosroes from the manly virtues of the great Tiridates. And as the pusillanimous monarch was averse to any enterprise of danger and glory, he could disguise his timid indolence by the more decent excuses of religion and gratitude. He expressed a pious attachment to the memory of Constantius, from whose hands he had received in marriage Olympias, the daughter of the prefect Oblivius, and the alliance of a female who had been educated as the destined wife of the emperor Constans, exalted the dignity of a barbarian king. Tyrannus professed the Christian religion. He reigned over a nation of Christians, and he was restrained by every principle of conscience and interest from contributing to the victory which would consummate the ruin of the church. The alienated mind of Tyrannus was exasperated by the indiscretion of Julian, who treated the king of Armenia as his slave and as the enemy of the gods. The haughty and threatening style of the imperial mandates awakened the secret indignation of a prince who, in the humiliating state of dependence, was still conscious of his royal descent from the Arsacides, the lords of the East and the rivals of the Roman power. The military dispositions of Julian were skillfully contrived to deceive the spies and to divert the attention of Sapor. The legions appeared to direct their march towards Nisibis and the Tigris. On a sudden they wheeled to the right, traversed the level and naked plain of Kahi, and reached on the third day the banks of the Euphrates, where the strong town of Nisiphorium or Callinicum had been founded by the Macedonian kings. From thence the emperor pursued his march above 90 miles along the winding stream of the Euphrates, till at length, about 1 month after his departure from Antioch, he discovered the towers of Circassium, the extreme limit of the Roman dominions. The army of Julian, the most numerous that any of the Caesars had ever led against Persia, consisted of 65,000 effective and well-disciplined soldiers. The veteran bands of cavalry and infantry, of Romans and barbarians, had been selected from the different provinces, and a just preeminence of loyalty and valor was claimed by the hardy Gauls, who guarded the throne and person of their beloved prince. A formidable body of Scythian auxiliaries had been transported from another climate, and almost from another world, to invade a distant country of whose name and situation they were ignorant. The love of rapine and war allured to the imperial standard several tribes of Saracens or roving Arabs, whose service Julian had commanded while he sternly refused the payment of the accustomed subsidies. The broad channel of the Euphrates was crowded by a fleet of 1,100 ships destined to attend the motions and to satisfy the wants of the Roman army. The military strength of the fleet was composed of 50 armed galleys, and these were accompanied by an equal number of flat-bottomed boats, which might occasionally be connected into the form of temporary bridges. The rest of the ships, partly constructed of timber and partly covered with raw hides, were laden with an almost inexhaustible supply of arms and engines, of utensils and provisions. The vigilant humanity of Julian had embarked a very large magazine of vinegar and biscuit for the use of the soldiers, but he prohibited the indulgence of wine, and rigorously stopped a long string of superfluous camels that attempted to follow the rear of the army. The river Chaboras falls into the Euphrates at Circesium, and as soon as the trumpet gave the signal of march, the Romans passed the little stream which separated two mighty and hostile empires. The custom of ancient discipline required a military oration, and Julian embraced every opportunity of displaying his eloquence. He animated the impatient and attentive legions by the example of the inflexible courage and glorious triumphs of their ancestors. He excited their resentment by a lively picture of the insolence of the Persians, and he exhorted them to imitate his firm resolution, either to extirpate that perfidious nation or to devote his life in the cause of the Republic. The eloquence of Julian was enforced by a donative of 130 pieces of silver to every soldier, and the bridge of the Chaboras was instantly cut away to convince the troops that they must place their hopes of safety in the success of their arms. Yet the prudence of the emperor induced him to secure a remote frontier, perpetually exposed to the inroads of the hostile Arabs. A detachment of 4,000 men was left at Circesium, which completed, to the number of 10,000, the regular garrison of that important fortress. From the moment that the Romans entered the enemy's country, the country of an active and artful enemy, the order of march was disposed in three columns. The strength of the infantry, and consequently of the whole army, was placed in the center, under the peculiar command of their master general, Victor. On the right, the brave Nivita led a column of several legions along the banks of the Euphrates, and almost always in sight of the fleet. The left flank of the army was protected by the column of cavalry. Hormisdas and Arinthius were appointed generals of the horse, and the singular adventures of Hormisdas are not undeserving of our notice. He was a Persian prince of the royal race of the Sassanides, who, in the troubles of the minority of Sapor, had escaped from prison to the hospitable court of the great Constantine. Hormisdas at first excited the compassion and at length acquired the esteem of his new masters. His valor and fidelity raised him to the military honors of the Roman service, and, though a Christian, he might indulge the secret satisfaction of convincing his ungrateful country that an oppressed subject may prove the most dangerous enemy. Such was the disposition of the three principal columns. The front and flanks of the army were covered by Lucilianus with a flying detachment of 1,500 light-armed soldiers, whose active vigilance observed the most distant signs and conveyed the earliest notice of any hostile approach. Dagalaiphus and Secundinus, Duke of Osrini, conducted the troops of the rear guard. The baggage securely proceeded in the intervals of the columns, and the ranks, from a motive either of use or ostentation, were formed in such open order that the whole line of march extended almost 10 miles. The ordinary post of Julian was at the head of the center column, but as he preferred the duties of a general to the state of a monarch, he rapidly moved, with a small escort of light cavalry, to the front, the rear, the flanks, wherever his presence could animate or protect the march of the Roman army. The country which they traversed from the Chaboras to the cultivated lands of Assyria may be considered as a part of the desert of Arabia, a dry and barren waste which could never be improved by the most powerful arts of human industry. Julian marched over the same ground which had been trod above 700 years before by the footsteps of the younger Cyrus, and which is described by one of the companions of his expedition, the sage and heroic Xenophon. The country was a plain throughout, as even as the sea, and full of wormwood. And if any other kind of shrubs or reeds grew there, they had all an aromatic smell, but no trees could be seen. Bustards and ostriches, antelopes and wild asses, appeared to be the only inhabitants of the desert, and the fatigues of the march were alleviated by the amusements of the chase. The loose sand of the desert was frequently raised by the wind into clouds of dust, and a great number of the soldiers of Julian, with their tents, were suddenly thrown to the ground by the violence of an unexpected hurricane. The sandy plains of Mesopotamia were abandoned to the antelopes and wild asses of the desert. But a variety of populous towns and villages were pleasantly situated on the banks of the Euphrates, and in the islands which are occasionally formed by that river. The city of Anah, or Anatho, the actual residence of an Arabian emir, is composed of two long streets which enclose, within a natural fortification, a small island in the midst, and two fruitful spots on either side of the Euphrates. The warlike inhabitants of Anatho showed a disposition to stop the march of a Roman emperor, till they were diverted from such fatal presumption by the mild exhortations of Prince Hormisdas and the approaching terrors of the fleet and army. They implored and experienced the clemency of Julian, who transplanted the people to an advantageous settlement near Colchis in Syria, and admitted Pusius, the governor, to an honorable rank in his service and friendship. But the impregnable fortress of Thelutha could scorn the menace of a siege, and the emperor was obliged to content himself with an insulting promise that when he had subdued the interior provinces of Persia, Thelutha would no longer refuse to grace the triumph of the emperor. The inhabitants of the open towns, unable to resist and unwilling to yield, fled with precipitation, and their houses, filled with spoil and provisions, were occupied by the soldiers of Julian, who massacred, without remorse and without punishment, some defenseless women. During the march, the Surinas, or Persian general, and Malek Rhodosakis, the renowned emir of the tribe of Ghassan, incessantly hovered round the army. Every straggler was intercepted, every detachment was attacked, and the valiant Hormisdas escaped with some difficulty from their hands. But the barbarians were finally repulsed. The country became every day less favorable to the operations of cavalry, and when the Romans arrived at Macapracta, they perceived the ruins of the wall, which had been constructed by the ancient kings of Assyria to secure their dominions from the incursions of the Medes. These preliminaries of the expedition of Julian appear to have employed about 15 days, and we may compute near 300 miles from the fortress of Circesium to the wall of Macapracta. The fertile province of Assyria, which stretched beyond the Tigris as far as the mountains of Media, extended about 400 miles from the ancient wall of Macapracta to the territory of Basra, where the united streams of the Euphrates and Tigris discharged themselves into the Persian Gulf. The whole country might have claimed the peculiar name of Mesopotamia, as the two rivers, which are never more distant than 50, approach between Baghdad and Babylon within 25 miles of each other. A multitude of artificial canals, dug without much labor in a soft and yielding soil, connected the rivers and intersected the plain of Assyria. The uses of these artificial canals were various and important. They served to discharge the superfluous waters from one river into the other at the season of their respective inundations. Subdividing themselves into smaller and smaller branches, they refreshed the dry lands and supplied the deficiency of rain. They facilitated the intercourse of peace and commerce, and as the dams could be speedily broken down, they armed the despair of the Assyrians with the means of opposing a sudden deluge to the progress of an invading army. To the soil and climate of Assyria, nature had denied some of her choicest gifts, the vine, the olive, and the fig tree. But the food which supports the life of man, and particularly wheat and barley, were produced with inexhaustible fertility, and the husbandman who committed his seed to the earth was frequently rewarded with an increase of 200 or even of 300. The face of the country was interspersed with groves of innumerable palm trees, and the diligent natives celebrated, either in verse or prose, the 360 uses to which the trunk, the branches, the leaves, the juice, and the fruit were skillfully applied. Several manufactures, especially those of leather and linen, employed the industry of a numerous people, and afforded valuable materials for foreign trade, which appears, however, to have been conducted by the hands of strangers. Babylon had been converted into a royal park, but near the ruins of the ancient capital, new cities had successively arisen, and the populousness of the country was displayed in the multitude of towns and villages, which were built of bricks dried in the sun, and strongly cemented with bitumen. The natural and peculiar production of the Babylonian soil. While the successors of Cyrus reigned over Asia, the province of Syria alone maintained, during a third part of the year, the luxurious plenty of the table and household of the great king. 4 considerable villages were assigned for the subsistence of his Indian dogs. 800 stallions and 16,000 mares were constantly kept at the expense of the country for the royal stables. And as the daily tribute which was paid to the satrap amounted to 1 English bushel of silver, we may compute the annual revenue of Assyria at more than £1,200 sterling. The fields of Assyria were devoted by Julian to the calamities of war, and the philosopher retaliated on a guiltless people the acts of rapine and cruelty which had been committed by their haughty master in the Roman provinces. The trembling Assyrians summoned the rivers to their assistance, and completed with their own hands the ruin of their country. The roads were rendered impracticable. A flood of waters was poured into the camp, and during several days the troops of Julian were obliged to contend with the most discouraging hardships. But every obstacle was surmounted by the perseverance of the legionaries, who were inured to toil as well as to danger, and who felt themselves animated by the spirit of their leader. The damage was gradually repaired. The waters were restored to their proper channels. Whole groves of palm trees were cut down and placed along the broken parts of the road, and the army passed over the broad and deeper canals on bridges of floating rafts which were supported by the help of bladders. 2 cities of Assyria presumed to resist the arms of a Roman emperor, and they both paid the severe penalty of their rashness. At the distance of 50 miles from the royal residence of Ctesiphon, Perisabor, or Anbar, held the second rank in the province. A city, large, populous, and well fortified, surrounded with a double wall, almost encompassed by a branch of the Euphrates, and defended by the valor of a numerous garrison. The exhortations of Hormisdas were repulsed with contempt, and the ears of the Persian prince were wounded by a just reproach that, unmindful of his royal birth, he conducted an army of strangers against his king and country. The Assyrians maintained their loyalty by a skillful as well as vigorous defense, till the lucky stroke of a battering ram, having opened a large breach by shattering one of the angles of the wall, they hastily retired into the fortifications of the interior citadel. The soldiers of Julian rushed impetuously into the town, and after the full gratification of every military appetite, Perisabor was reduced to ashes, and the engines which assaulted the citadel were planted on the ruins of the smoking houses. The contest was continued by an incessant and mutual discharge of missile weapons, and the superiority which the Romans might derive from the mechanical powers of their ballistae and catapulti was counterbalanced by the advantage of the ground on the side of the besieged. But as soon as an Helepolis had been constructed, which could engage on equal terms with the loftiest ramparts, the tremendous aspect of a moving turret that would leave no hope of resistance or mercy terrified the defenders of the citadel into an humble submission. And the place was surrendered only 2 days after Julian first appeared under the walls of Perisabor. 2,500 persons of both sexes, the feeble remnant of a flourishing people, were permitted to retire. The plentiful magazines of corn, of arms, and of splendid furniture were partly distributed among the troops, and partly reserved for the public service. The useless stores were destroyed by fire, or thrown into the stream of the Euphrates, and the fate of Amida was revenged by the total ruin of Perisabor. The city, or rather fortress, of Meogamalca, which was defended by 16 large towers, a deep ditch, and 2 strong and solid walls of brick and bitumen, appears to have been constructed at the distance of 11 miles as the safeguard of the capital of Persia. The emperor, apprehensive of leaving such an important fortress in his rear, immediately formed the siege of Meogamalca, and the Roman army was distributed, for that purpose, into 3 divisions. Victor, at the head of the cavalry and of a detachment of heavy armed foot, was ordered to clear the country as far as the banks of the Tigris and the suburbs of Ctesiphon. The conduct of the attack was assumed by Julian himself, who seemed to place his whole dependence in the military engines which he erected against the walls, while he secretly contrived a more efficacious method of introducing his troops into the heart of the city. Under the direction of Nevita and Dagalaphus, the trenches were opened at a considerable distance, and gradually prolonged as far as the edge of the ditch. The ditch was speedily filled with earth, and by the incessant labor of the troops, a mine was carried under the foundations of the walls, and sustained at sufficient intervals by props of timber. 3 chosen cohorts, advancing in a single file, silently explored the dark and dangerous passage, till their intrepid leader whispered back the intelligence that he was ready to issue from his confinement into the streets of the hostile city. Julian checked their ardor that he might ensure their success, and immediately diverted the attention of the garrison by the tumult and clamor of a general assault. The Persians, who from their walls contemptuously beheld the progress of an impotent attack, celebrated with songs of triumph the glory of Sapor, and ventured to assure the emperor that he might ascend the starry mansion of Ormuzd before he could hope to take the impregnable city of Meogamalca. The city was already taken. History has recorded the name of a private soldier who first ascended from the mine into a deserted tower. The passage was widened by his companions, who pressed forwards with impatient valor. 1,500 enemies were already in the midst of the city. The astonished garrison abandoned the walls and their only hope of safety. The gates were instantly burst open, and the revenge of the soldier, unless it were suspended by lust or avarice, was satiated by an undistinguishing massacre. The governor, who had yielded on a promise of mercy, was burnt alive a few days afterwards on a charge of having uttered some disrespectful words against the honor of Prince Hormisdas. The fortifications were razed to the ground, and not a vestige was left that the city of Meogamalca had ever existed. The neighborhood of the capital of Persia was adorned with 3 stately palaces, laboriously enriched with every production that could gratify the luxury and pride of an eastern monarch. The pleasant situation of the gardens along the banks of the Tigris was improved according to the Persian taste by the symmetry of flowers, fountains, and shady walks, and spacious parks were enclosed for the reception of the bears, lions, and wild boars, which were maintained at a considerable expense for the pleasure of the royal chase. The park walls were broken down, the savage game was abandoned to the darts of the soldiers, and the palaces of Sapor were reduced to ashes by the command of the Roman Emperor. Julian, on this occasion, showed himself ignorant or careless of the laws of civility which the prudence and refinement of polished ages have established between hostile princes. Yet these wanton ravages need not excite in our breasts any vehement emotions of pity or resentment. A simple naked statue, finished by the hand of a Grecian artist, is of more genuine value than all these rude and costly monuments of barbaric labor. And if we are more deeply affected by the ruin of a palace than by the conflagration of a cottage, our humanity must have formed a very erroneous estimate of the miseries of human life. Julian was an object of hatred and terror to the Persian, and the painters of that nation represented the invader of their country under the emblem of a furious lion, who vomited from his mouth a consuming fire. To his friends and soldiers, the philosophic hero appeared in a more amiable light, and his virtues were never more conspicuously displayed than in the last and most active period of his life. He practiced without effort and almost without merit the habitual qualities of temperance and sobriety. According to the dictates of that artificial wisdom which assumes an absolute dominion over the mind and body, he sternly refused himself the indulgence of the most natural appetites. In the warm climate of Assyria, which solicited a luxurious people to the gratification of every sensual desire, a youthful conqueror preserved his chastity pure and inviolate. Nor was Julian ever tempted, even by a motive of curiosity, to visit his female captives of exquisite beauty, who, instead of resisting his power, would have disputed with each other the honor of his embraces. With the same firmness that he resisted the allurements of love, he sustained the hardships of war. When the Romans marched through the flat and flooded country, their sovereign, on foot, at the head of his legions, shared their fatigues and animated their diligence. In every useful labor, the hand of Julian was prompt and strenuous, and the imperial purple was wet and dirty as the coarse garment of the meanest soldier. The two sieges allowed him some remarkable opportunities of signalizing his personal valor, which in the improved state of the military art can seldom be exerted by a prudent general. The emperor stood before the citadel of Perisabor, insensible of his extreme danger, and encouraged his troops to burst open the gates of iron, till he was almost overwhelmed under a cloud of missile weapons and huge stones that were directed against his person. As he examined the exterior fortifications of Mea Gamalka, two Persians devoting themselves for their country suddenly rushed upon him with drawn scimitars. The emperor dexterously received their blows on his uplifted shield, and with a steady and well-aimed thrust laid one of his adversaries dead at his feet. The esteem of a prince who possesses the virtues which he approves is the noblest recompense of a deserving subject, and the authority which Julian derived from his personal merit enabled him to revive and enforce the rigor of ancient discipline. He punished with death or ignominy the misbehavior of three troops of horse, who in a skirmish with the Cyrenas had lost their honor and one of their standards. And he distinguished with obsidional crowns the valor of the foremost soldiers who had ascended into the city of Mea Gamalka. After the siege of Perisabor, the firmness of the emperor was exercised by the insolent avarice of the army, who loudly complained that their services were rewarded by a trifling donative of 100 pieces of silver. His just indignation was expressed in the grave and manly language of a Roman. Riches are the object of your desires. Those riches are in the hands of the Persians, and the spoils of this fruitful country are proposed as the prize of your valor and discipline. Believe me, added Julian, The Roman Republic, which formerly possessed such immense treasures, is now reduced to want and wretchedness once our princes have been persuaded by weak and interested ministers to purchase with gold the tranquillity of the barbarians. The revenue is exhausted. The cities are ruined. The provinces are dispeopled. For myself, the only inheritance that I have received from my royal ancestors is a soul incapable of fear. And as long as I am convinced that every real advantage is seated in the mind, I shall not blush to acknowledge an honorable poverty, which in the days of ancient virtue was considered as the glory of Fabricius. That glory and that virtue may be your own if you will listen to the voice of heaven and of your leader. But if you will rashly persist, if you are determined to renew the shameful and mischievous examples of old seditions, proceed. As it becomes an emperor who has filled the first rank among men, I am prepared to die standing, and to despise a precarious life which every hour may depend on an accidental fever. If I have been found unworthy of the command, there are now among you, I speak it with pride and pleasure, there are many chiefs whose merit and experience are equal to the conduct of the most important war. Such has been the temper of my reign, that I can retire, without regret and without apprehension, to the obscurity of a private station. The modest resolution of Julian was answered by the unanimous applause and cheerful obedience of the Romans, who declared their confidence of victory while they fought under the banners of their heroic prince. Their courage was kindled by his frequent and familiar asseverations, for such wishes were the oaths of Julian. So may I reduce the Persians under the yoke. Thus may I restore the strength and splendor of the Republic. The love of fame was the ardent passion of his soul. But it was not before he trampled on the ruins of Meogamalca that he allowed himself to say, "We have now provided some materials for the sophist of Antioch." The successful valor of Julian had triumphed over all the obstacles that opposed his march to the gates of Ctesiphon. But the reduction or even the siege of the capital of Persia was still at a distance, nor can the military conduct of the emperor be clearly apprehended without a knowledge of the country which was the theatre of his bold and skilful operations. 20 miles to the south of Baghdad and on the eastern bank of the Tigris, the curiosity of travellers has observed some ruins of the palaces of Ctesiphon, which in the time of Julian was a great and populous city. The name and glory of the adjacent Seleucia were forever extinguished, and the only remaining quarter of that Greek colony had resumed with the Assyrian language and manners the primitive appellation of Koki. Koki was situated on the western side of the Tigris, but it was naturally considered as a suburb of Ctesiphon, with which we may suppose it to have been connected by a permanent bridge of boats. The united parts contributed to form the common epithet of Al-Moden, the cities which the Orientals have bestowed on the winter residence of the Sassanides, and the whole circumference of the Persian capital was strongly fortified by the waters of the river, by lofty walls, and by impracticable morasses. Near the ruins of Seleucia, the camp of Julian was fixed and secured by a ditch and rampart against the sallies of the numerous and enterprising garrison of Koki. In this fruitful and pleasant country, the Romans were plentifully supplied with water and forage, and several forts, which might have embarrassed the motions of the army, submitted, after some resistance, to the efforts of their valor. The fleet passed from the Euphrates into an artificial derivation of that river, which pours a copious and navigable stream into the Tigris at a small distance below the great city. If they had followed this royal canal, which bore the name of Nahar Malka, the intermediate situation of Koki would have separated the fleet and army of Julian. and the rash attempt of steering against the current of the Tigris and forcing their way through the midst of a hostile capital must have been attended with the total destruction of the Roman navy. The prudence of the emperor foresaw the danger and provided the remedy. As he had minutely studied the operations of Trajan in the same country, he soon recollected that his warlike predecessor had dug a new and navigable canal, which, leaving Colchi on the right hand, conveyed the waters of the Nahamalka into the river Tigris at some distance above the cities. From the information of the peasants, Julian ascertained the vestiges of this ancient work, which were almost obliterated by design or accident. By the indefatigable labor of the soldiers, a broad and deep channel was speedily prepared for the reception of the Euphrates. A strong dike was constructed to interrupt the ordinary current of the Nahamalka. A flood of waters rushed impetuously into their new bed, and the Roman fleet, steering their triumphant course into the Tigris, derided the vain and ineffectual barriers which the Persians of Ctesiphon had erected to oppose their passage. As it became necessary to transport the Roman army over the Tigris, another labor presented itself, of less toil but of more danger than the preceding expedition. The stream was broad and rapid, the ascent steep and difficult, and the entrenchments which had been formed on the ridge of the opposite bank were lined with a numerous army of heavy cuirassiers, dexterous archers, and huge elephants, who, according to the extravagant hyperbole of Libanius, could trample with the same ease a field of corn or a legion of Romans. In the presence of such an enemy, the construction of a bridge was impracticable, and the intrepid prince, who instantly seized the only possible expedient, concealed his design till the moment of execution from the knowledge of the barbarians, of his own troops, and even of his generals themselves. Under the specious pretense of examining the state of the magazines, 40 vessels were gradually unladen, and a select detachment, apparently destined for some secret expedition, was ordered to stand to their arms on the first signal. Julian disguised the silent anxiety of his own mind with smiles of confidence and joy, and amused the hostile nations with the spectacle of military games which he insultingly celebrated under the walls of Colchi. The day was consecrated to pleasure, but as soon as the hour of supper was past, the emperor summoned the generals to his tent, and acquainted them that he had fixed that night for the passage of the Tigris. They stood in silent and respectful astonishment, but when the venerable Sallust assumed the privilege of his age and experience, the rest of the chiefs supported with freedom the weight of his prudent remonstrances. Julian contented himself with observing that conquest and safety depended on the attempt, that instead of diminishing, the number of their enemies would be increased by successive reinforcements, and that a longer delay would neither contract the breadth of the stream nor level the height of the bank. The signal was instantly given and obeyed. The most impatient of the legionaries leaped into 5 vessels that lay nearest to the bank, and as they plied their oars with intrepid diligence, they were lost after a few moments in the darkness of the night. A flame arose on the opposite side, and Julian, who too clearly understood that his foremost vessels, in attempting to land, had been fired by the enemy, dexterously converted their extreme danger into a presage of victory. "Our fellow soldiers," he eagerly exclaimed, "are already masters of the bank. See, they make the appointed signal. Let us hasten to emulate and assist their courage." The united and rapid motion of a great fleet broke the violence of the current, and they reached the eastern shore of the Tigris with sufficient speed to extinguish the flames and rescue their adventurous companions. The difficulties of a steep and lofty ascent were increased by the weight of armor and the darkness of the night. A shower of stones, darts, and fire was incessantly discharged on the heads of the assailants, who, after an arduous struggle, climbed the bank and stood victorious upon the rampart. As soon as they possessed a more equal field, Julian, who with his light infantry had led the attack, darted through the ranks a skillful and experienced eye. His bravest soldiers, according to the precepts of Homer, were distributed in the front and rear, and all the trumpets of the imperial army sounded to battle. The Romans, after sending up a military shout, advanced in measured steps to the animating notes of martial music, launched their formidable javelins, and rushed forwards with drawn swords to deprive the barbarians by a closer onset of the advantage of their missile weapons. The whole engagement lasted above 12 hours, till the gradual retreat of the Persians was changed into a disorderly flight, of which the shameful example was given by the principal leader and the Surinas himself. They were pursued to the gates of Ctesiphon, and the conquerors might have entered the dismayed city, if their general Victor, who was dangerously wounded with an arrow, had not conjured them to desist from a rash attempt which must be fatal if it were not successful. On their side, the Romans acknowledged the loss of only 75 men, while they affirmed that the barbarians had left on the field of battle 2,500, or even 6,000, of their bravest soldiers. The spoil was such as might be expected from the riches and luxury of an Oriental camp. Large quantities of silver and gold, splendid arms and trappings, and beds and tables of massy silver. The victorious emperor distributed as the rewards of valor some honorable gifts, civic and mural and naval crowns, which he, and perhaps he alone, esteemed more precious than the wealth of Asia. A solemn sacrifice was offered to the god of war, but the appearances of the victims threatened the most inauspicious events, and Julian soon discovered by less ambiguous signs that he had now reached the term of his prosperity. On the second day after the battle, the domestic guards, the Jovians and Herculians, and the remaining troops, which composed near 2/3 of the whole army, were securely wafted over the Tigris. While the Persians beheld from the walls of Ctesiphon the desolation of the adjacent country, Julian cast many an anxious look towards the north, in full expectation that, as he himself had victoriously penetrated to the capital of Sapor, the march and junction of his lieutenants, Sebastian and Procopius, would be executed with the same courage and diligence. His expectations were disappointed by the treachery of the Armenian king, who permitted and most probably directed the desertion of his auxiliary troops from the camp of the Romans, and by the dissensions of the two generals, who were incapable of forming or executing any plan for the public service. When the emperor had relinquished the hope of this important reinforcement, he condescended to hold a council of war and approved, after a full debate, the sentiment of those generals who dissuaded the siege of Ctesiphon as a fruitless and pernicious undertaking. It is not easy for us to conceive by what arts of fortification a city thrice besieged and taken by the predecessors of Julian could be rendered impregnable against an army of 60,000 Romans commanded by a brave and experienced general and abundantly supplied with ships, provisions, battering engines, and military stores. But we may rest assured, from the love of glory and contempt of danger, which form the character of Julian, that he was not discouraged by any trivial or imaginary obstacles. At the very time when he declined the siege of Ctesiphon, he rejected with obstinacy and disdain the most flattering offers of a negotiation of peace. Sapor, who had been so long accustomed to the tardy ostentation of Constantius, was surprised by the intrepid diligence of his successor. As far as the confines of India and Scythia, the satraps of the distant provinces were ordered to assemble their troops and to march without delay to the assistance of their monarch. But their preparations were dilatory, their motions slow, and before Sapor could lead an army into the field, he received the melancholy intelligence of the devastation of Assyria, the ruin of his palaces, and the slaughter of his bravest troops who defended the passage of the Tigris. The pride of royalty was humbled in the dust. He took his repasts on the ground, and the disorder of his hair expressed the grief and anxiety of his mind. Perhaps he would not have refused to purchase, with one half of his kingdom, the safety of the remainder, and he would have gladly subscribed himself in a treaty of peace the faithful and dependent ally of the Roman conqueror. Under the pretense of private business, a minister of rank and confidence was secretly dispatched to embrace the knees of Hormisdas, and to request, in the language of a suppliant, that he might be introduced into the presence of the emperor. The Sasanian prince, whether he listened to the voice of pride or humanity, whether he consulted the sentiments of his birth or the duties of his situation, was equally inclined to promote a salutary measure which would terminate the calamities of Persia and secure the triumph of Rome. He was astonished by the inflexible firmness of a hero who remembered, most unfortunately for himself and for his country, that Alexander had uniformly rejected the propositions of Darius. But as Julian was sensible that the hope of a safe and honorable peace might cool the ardor of his troops, he earnestly requested that Hormisdas would privately dismiss the minister of Sapor and conceal this dangerous temptation from the knowledge of the camp. The honor as well as interest of Julian forbade him to consume his time under the impregnable walls of Ctesiphon, and as often as he defied the barbarians, who defended the city, to meet him on the open plain, they prudently replied that if he desired to exercise his valor, he might seek the army of the great king. He felt the insult, and he accepted the advice. Instead of confining his servile march to the banks of the Euphrates and Tigris, he resolved to imitate the adventurous spirit of Alexander, and boldly to advance into the inland provinces till he forced his rival to contend with him, perhaps in the plains of Arbela, for the empire of Asia. The magnanimity of Julian was applauded and betrayed by the arts of a noble Persian who, in the cause of his country, had generously submitted to act a part full of danger, of falsehood, and of shame. With a train of faithful followers, he deserted to the imperial camp, exposed in a specious tale the injuries which he had sustained, exaggerated the cruelty of Sapor, the discontent of the people, and the weakness of the monarchy, and confidently offered himself as the hostage and guide of the Roman march. The most rational grounds of suspicion were urged, without effect, by the wisdom and experience of Hormisdas, and the credulous Julian, receiving the traitor into his bosom, was persuaded to issue a hasty order, which, in the opinion of mankind, appeared to arraign his prudence and to endanger his safety. He destroyed in a single hour the whole navy which had been transported above 500 miles at so great an expense of toil, of treasure, and of blood. 12, or at the most 22 small vessels were saved to accompany on carriages the march of the army and to form occasional bridges for the passage of the rivers. A supply of 20 days' provisions was reserved for the use of the soldiers, and the rest of the magazines, with a fleet of 1,100 vessels which rode at anchor in the Tigris, were abandoned to the flames by the absolute command of the emperor. The Christian bishops, Gregory and Augustine, insult the madness of the apostate who executed with his own hands the sentence of divine justice. Their authority, of less weight, perhaps, in a military question, is confirmed by the cool judgment of an experienced soldier who was himself spectator of the conflagration, and who could not disapprove the reluctant murmurs of the troops. Yet there are not wanting some specious and perhaps solid reasons which might justify the resolution of Julian. The navigation of the Euphrates never ascended above Babylon, nor that of the Tigris above Opis. The distance of the last-mentioned city from the Roman camp was not very considerable, and Julian must soon have renounced the vain and impracticable attempt of forcing upwards a great fleet against the stream of a rapid river, which in several places was embarrassed by natural or artificial cataracts. The power of sails and oars was insufficient. It became necessary to tow the ships against the current of the river. The strength of 20,000 soldiers was exhausted in this tedious and servile labor, and if the Romans continued to march along the banks of the Tigris, they could only expect to return home without achieving any enterprise worthy of the genius or fortune of their leader. If, on the contrary, it was advisable to advance into the inland country, the destruction of the fleet and magazines was the only measure which could save that valuable prize from the hands of the numerous and active troops which might suctenly be poured from the gates of Ctesiphon. Had the arms of Julian been victorious, we should now admire the conduct as well as the courage of a hero who, by depriving his soldiers of the hopes of a retreat, left them only the alternative of death or conquest. The cumbersome train of artillery and wagons, which retards the operations of a modern army, were in a great measure unknown in the camps of the Romans. Yet in every age the subsistence of 60,000 men must have been one of the most important cares of a prudent general, and that subsistence could only be drawn from his own or from the enemy's country. Had it been possible for Julian to maintain a bridge of communication on the Tigris, and to preserve the conquered places of Assyria, a desolated province could not afford any large or regular supplies in a season of the year when the lands were covered by the inundation of the Euphrates, and the unwholesome air was darkened with swarms of innumerable insects. The appearance of the hostile country was far more inviting. The extensive region that lies between the river Tigris and the mountains of Media was filled with villages and towns, and the fertile soil, for the most part, was in a very improved state of cultivation. Julian might expect that a conqueror who possessed the two forcible instruments of persuasion, steel and gold, would easily procure a plentiful subsistence from the fears or avarice of the natives. But on the approach of the Romans, the rich and smiling prospect was instantly blasted. Wherever they moved, the inhabitants deserted the open villages and took shelter in the fortified towns. The cattle was driven away. The grass and ripe corn were consumed with fire. And as soon as the flames had subsided, which interrupted the march of Julian, he beheld the melancholy face of a smoking and naked desert. This desperate but effectual method of defense can only be executed by the enthusiasm of a people who prefer their independence to their property, or by the rigor of an arbitrary government which consults the public safety without submitting to their inclinations the liberty of choice. On the present occasion, the zeal and obedience of the Persians seconded the commands of Sapor, and the emperor was soon reduced to the scanty stock of provisions which continually wasted in his hands. Before they were entirely consumed, he might still have reached the wealthy and unwarlike cities of Ecbatana or Susa by the effort of a rapid and well-directed march. But he was deprived of this last resource by his ignorance of the roads and by the perfidy of his guides. The Romans wandered several days in the country to the eastward of Baghdad. The Persian deserter, who had artfully led them into the spur, escaped from their resentment, and his followers, as soon as they were put to the torture, confessed the secret of the conspiracy. The visionary conquests of Hyrcania and India, which had so long amused, now tormented the mind of Julian. Conscious that his own imprudence was the cause of the public distress, he anxiously balanced the hopes of safety or success without obtaining a satisfactory answer, either from gods or men. At length, as the only practicable measure, he embraced the resolution of directing his steps towards the banks of the Tigris, with the design of saving the army by a hasty march to the confines of Corduene, a fertile and friendly province which acknowledged the sovereignty of Rome. The desponding troops obeyed the signal of the retreat, only 70 days after they had passed the Chaboras, with the sanguine expectation of subverting the throne of Persia. As long as the Romans seemed to advance into the country, their march was observed and insulted from a distance by several bodies of Persian cavalry, who, showing themselves sometimes in loose and sometimes in close order, faintly skirmished with the advanced guards. These detachments were, however, supported by much greater force, and the heads of the columns were no sooner pointed towards the Tigris than a cloud of dust arose on the plain. The Romans, who now aspired only to the permission of a safe and speedy retreat, endeavoured to persuade themselves that this formidable appearance was occasioned by a troop of wild asses, or perhaps by the approach of some friendly Arabs. They halted, pitched their tents, fortified their camp, passed the whole night in continual alarms, and discovered at the dawn of day that they were surrounded by an army of Persians. This army, which might be considered only as the van of the barbarians, was soon followed by the main body of cuirassiers, archers, and elephants, commanded by Miranes, a general of rank and reputation. He was accompanied by two of the king's sons, and many of the principal satraps, and fame and expectation exaggerated the strength of the remaining powers, which slowly advanced under the conduct of Sapor himself. As the Romans continued their march, their long array, which was forced to bend or divide according to the varieties of the ground, afforded frequent and favorable opportunities to their vigilant enemies. The Persians repeatedly charged with fury. They were repeatedly repulsed with firmness. And the action at Moronga, which almost deserved the name of a battle, was marked by a considerable loss of satraps and elephants, perhaps of equal value in the eyes of their monarch. These splendid advantages were not obtained without an adequate slaughter on the side of the Romans. Several officers of distinction were either killed or wounded, and the emperor himself, who, on all occasions of danger, inspired and guided the valor of his troops, was obliged to expose his person and exert his abilities. The weight of offensive and defensive arms, which still constituted the strength and safety of the Romans, disabled them from making any long or effectual pursuit, and as the horsemen of the East were trained to dart their javelins and shoot their arrows at full speed and in every possible direction, the cavalry of Persia was never more formidable than in the moment of a rapid and disorderly flight. But the most certain and irreparable loss of the Romans was that of time. The hardy veterans, accustomed to the cold climate of Gaul and Germany, fainted under the sultry heat of an Assyrian summer. Their vigor was exhausted by the incessant repetition of march and combat, and the progress of the army was suspended by the precautions of a slow and dangerous retreat in the presence of an active enemy. Every day, every hour, as the supply diminished, the value and price of subsistence increased in the Roman camp. Julian, who always contented himself with such food as a hungry soldier would have disdained, distributed for the use of the troops the provisions of the imperial household, and whatever could be spared from the sumpter horses of the tribunes and generals. But this feeble relief served only to aggravate the sense of the public distress, and the Romans began to entertain the most gloomy apprehensions that before they could reach the frontiers of the empire, they should all perish, either by famine or by the sword of the barbarians. While Julian struggled with the almost insuperable difficulties of his situation, the silent hours of the night were still devoted to study and contemplation. Whenever he closed his eyes in short and interrupted slumbers, his mind was agitated with painful anxiety. Nor can it be thought surprising that the genius of the empire should once more appear before him, covering with a funeral veil his head.